All right, all right, all right. Yeah. All right. That is the familiar sound that you hear when we review movies every Monday morning right here on 720 WGN on the Nick DiGilio Show. And we're doing that right now. But we are doing our year-end show. And this is when Colin Suter and Eric Childress, who join me every week, every Monday morning to review movies, they come down to the studio and we talk about the year in movies. We talk about everything. In fact, the entire show this morning is dedicated to the year in movies. We will each unveil our year-end lists, the best movies of the year, the worst movies of the year, and then we have some categories and some subcategories that we're going to get into, and we will just talk about the movies in general for the year 2015. And, yeah, our phone number is 312-981-7200. You can send your text to that same number, 312-981-7200. And so without any further ado, because we got a lot to get to this morning, it's always a packed show when we do our yearly best and worst of. So let us say hello and good morning to the guys. Colin Suter, hello, Colin.
Hello there.
And Eric Childress, hello.
Hello.
Oh, wait a minute.
Hello.
Hello.
Wait, hold on a minute.
Hello.
You know, by the way, I've been on vacation for a week. I forgot what mic you were on. That's what's happened.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Oh,
and I like you both of you. I like your glasses and your cell phone. And in fact, I am a Verizon member. Okay, welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Seems like only a couple of weeks ago you guys were down here.
Yeah. There was a special thing going on.
And that little Star Wars movie, which made a few bucks. A
little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I forgot to bring my toys tonight.
You didn't bring your... They brought their friggin' toys with them. That's from Slapshot, ladies and gentlemen. Star Wars, which has now grossed $740 million.
Yep. Bye, Avatar.
Yeah, well... Avatar. God. All right, so now we're going to be talking about the best and worst movies of 2015 and everything in between. You know, like I said, the whole show is dedicated to that this morning, except for when my dad calls in and tells a joke. Jokey time. And we will replay the Blackhawks Express to give you a recap on what happened during the Hawks game last night. They won, which is a good thing. Okay, but we should talk in general first, Colin. Because we always start with Colin, right? Colin and then Eric and then me. Me and then Colin and then Eric, right?
Sure.
When we do our lists.
I think that works.
Yeah, that's how we usually do it. But let's start with how you guys felt about the year 2015 in general as a movie year. Colin?
I feel pretty strongly about it. I think you're going to hear three very different lists, best of the year lists, and I'm not going to have too many disagreements with any of them. There are going to be movies that I, you know, have in my top 20 that aren't in your top 20s, but I'll have it in my top 30 or my top 40 because I think it was a really strong year, more so in the second half than in the first half. A lot of stuff, most of my stuff in on my list is from the second half of the year. So, I just think, you know, this was a great year for breakout filmmakers, a lot of unknown filmmakers turning in some great work, and the return of some old pros as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Eric.
Well, this was one of those years that I think there wasn't a lot of middle of the road stuff. There was a lot of great or really awesome. You know, that's the sort of year we were dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot more 3.5 and 4-star movies than there were sort of 3-star movies that we just kind of liked. Mm-hmm. And those movies that Colin's talking about that we're going to be talking about tonight are the movies that stand far and above any negative experiences we had throughout the year, which there were many of.
Sure.
But I can't think of those right now. I'm only thinking about the greatness of 2015, and there was a lot of it.
I was thinking about this as well, you know, as I was putting my list together. And did you guys find it as difficult as I did this year to rank movies?
Yes.
Absolutely.
It was unbelievable because there were, like, I'd look at a movie that, like, ended up, you know, I look at my list and I'm like, oh, that ended up at number 9. That could have been number 1.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously,
mm-hmm.
It could have been number 1 any other year. And I kind of equate the last time I felt this strongly about the quality of so many movies in one year was 1999.
Hmm.
And I remember 1999 being an extraordinary year. And it was, for me, there were years, you know, since then. But I just remember that being like a watershed year.
It was a coming out party for a lot of filmmakers that year. I mean, David O. Russell with Three Kings. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had some stuff. Obviously, Paul Thomas Anderson at Magnolia that year. Being John Malkovich was that year. Blair Witch Project. I mean, there's a lot of really great stuff that year.
Just really great. And you know, like, there's an interesting thing here because, like, some filmmakers came out with movies that, you know, that were kind of unusual in 99. And a little bit under the radar. The Matrix was that year too, which was a groundbreaking, you know, landmark film. But like a director like Cronenberg made a movie like Existence that year,
right?
And that was a remarkable piece of work that I think stands the test of time. But one of those movies, like some that are going to be on our list, that people maybe didn't see,
right? Yeah,
and that's another thing. I thought it was a great. I thought 2015 was a great year. Let's talk about documentaries because documentaries each year. You know, they're included on our top 20 lists because we're going to do 20 best of and 20 worst. We'll get to the worst last. But we got a list of 20 here, like honorable mentions, runners up, and then the top 10. So 20 best films of the year. I separated the documentaries this year. So there are no documentaries on my list of top 20. Now, I know you guys probably didn't do that, but I did. So it doesn't mean that these documentaries that I chose as my 10 favorite of the year wouldn't have ended up at any other time.
It would certainly help my top 20 list if I just eliminated documentaries. Well,
that's what I did. That's what I did. Because I was like, what the hell? I can't, you know.
Exactly.
So I decided, screw it. This year I'm doing a top 10 documentary list. And if a documentary, because none of them ended up on my top 20.
Right.
But if a documentary ends up on your top 20, we can expound upon them then. I am just going to go through my top 10 documentaries from 10 to 1, and then Colin, you do yours, and then Eric, you do yours.
Okay.
So I'll just do my top 10, and you know, if you guys, we can talk a little bit about them later, and the ones that end up on your top 20 we'll expound upon. But here are my top 10 documentaries of the year. Number 10, Hitchcock Truffaut. Number 9, Amy. Number 8, Best of Enemies. Number 7, Call Me Lucky. And Bobcat Goldthwait, by the way, continues to be an incredible filmmaker. So during the break, I pulled out World's Greatest Dad and watched that for the first time in a while. And that movie is just amazing. Mm-hmm. Number 6, The Hunting Ground. Number 5, Listen to Me, Marlon. Number 6, Going Clear. A lot of people saw that on HBO, the Scientology.
Counted.
Yep. I don't care. It was amazing.
Yeah, right.
Number 3, Electric Boogaloo, the canon movie. Number 2, The Look of Silence. Number 1, Cartel Land, which I think is one of the most astonishing documentaries I've ever seen in my life. How this filmmaker got some of the footage in this movie. How he's alive. So Cartel Land is my favorite documentary of the year, and many of these in any other year would have made and are worthy to be on the best list of any movies. All right, what are your top 10 docs, Colin?
Number 10, The Look of Silence. Number 9, Terror. And that's the word terror with parentheses around the T, so it looks like error, but it's terror. Number 8, Kurt Cobain, Montage of Heck. Number 7, Heart of a Dog. That's Laurie Anderson's very strange documentary about her dog. Number 6, Call Me Lucky. Number 5, Amy. Number 4, Going Clear. Number 3, The Hunting Ground. Number 2, Listen to Me, Marlon. And number 1 is also Cartel Land.
Okay, cool. All right, Eric?
Number 10 is Electric Boogaloo, the wild untold story of Canon Films. Number 9, Steve Jobs, The Man and the Machine. 8, An Honest Liar, about a very kooky famous magician. 7, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. 6, Going Clear. 5, Bat Kid Begins. Number 4, Amy. Number 3, The Hunting Ground. Number 2, Listen to Me, Marlon. And number 1, Call Me Lucky.
Wow. Okay, Cartel Land didn't even make your top 10.
No.
Wow.
I didn't see it.
Oh! Well, I was going to say that has to be the only explanation.
Yeah.
It's got to be.
Yeah.
It's an amazing film, Eric. You got to see it. You got to see it. So Call Me Lucky, number 1, huh?
Yes, my favorite doc of the year.
Yeah. All right, cool. Well, so those are documentaries. Why do you guys think that, you know, we've been doing this for a long time, you know, unveiling our lists. What is it every year, it seems, that some of the best films of the year are documentaries? More and more documentaries seem to be made, number 1, and end up being best movies of the year. Do you guys really quickly have anything to say about that, Colin?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with, I mean, it's not just this year, but like the last decade and a half, because digital filmmaking has allowed filmmakers unprecedented access without the, you know, the burden of a large camera crew and a lot of excess technology. I mean, you can basically, I mean, we saw a movie this year that was made on an iPhone, a movie called Tangerine, and that's where we're at. And it's I thought that was a really really terrific movie. And you'd never guess it was made on an iPhone when you watch it. And I think that lends itself also to documentary. I mean, it's there's just a lot of people out there who who find great stories to tell and find easy ways of telling them on the production side of it.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, everything Colin just said about the advent of how simple it is in a way, you know, just from a technical standpoint to make films these days, you know, anyone with a camera can, you know, go out there and do something. But it's amazing to me how many great stories there are out there. Just, I mean, the way that filmmakers are finding new ways to explore certain stories and to introduce us to stories that we might not have the full picture on. I mean, look what's going on right now with Netflix and Making a Murderer.
Yeah.
You know, people are binge-watching into 10 hours worth of stuff, and it's not exactly uplifting material either.
Right.
So it's just the way that these filmmakers have access and the way that they've been, the dedication that they've had to putting these things together, and because documentaries take a couple years sometimes to make, some of the really good ones do, and I think that that aspect of it is really, I think people have the hunger for truth these days, and I think that's where they're finding it is in documentaries.
All right. Yeah, I agree. It's all good stuff, and we're going to take a quick break. So those are the docs, and many of those will reappear, I believe, on Eric and Colin's regular movie list, which we're going to get to. The top 20 best movies of the year coming up right after the news right here on 720 WGN. Please stick around.
It's been a long day without you, my friend. And I'll tell you all about it when I see you again. We've come a long way from where we began. Oh, I'll tell you all.
All right, welcome back to the show. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN.
When I see you again.
So the last thing I ever expected to happen while watching a Furious movie was for me to get teared up.
The song helps.
But that, yeah, this is a great song.
Yeah.
But that's exactly what happened during the last 5 minutes of that damn movie. One of the Fast and the Furious movies made me well up. we are celebrating the movies of 2015, and during the breaks when we come back, we're going to be celebrating the music from the movies of 2015. Some of these movies won't make our lists, like that one. I'm assuming it didn't make either of your lists.
Nah.
It's not on your list?
No, it's not.
That shocks me.
No, it's not on my list.
Any other year,
in the top five, man. That's how good this year was.
Right.
I actually found 20 movies better than Furious 7.
Wow.
Which I actually, I don't think it's the best one. Well, I think the sixth one is still the best one.
I think
that's the sixth one, right? Is the sixth one where they're dragging the
safe? It's the one where they're in the cars and they're going
and they're
really
going fast and the rocks
furious.
In it. No, but what's the one with where they're dragging the safe behind?
That's five.
Okay, five's the best one.
Mm.
Well, actually, the first one's all right. Let's not get into this.
Right.
it's Colin Suter and Eric Childress and I having an intelligent discussion about the Fast and Furious films.
Only here on WGN.
That's right, your station for Fast and Furious. we're talking about the best movies of the year. We're going to get that underway right now. We have chosen 20, and we will start with number 20 and move our way up to number 1. So I will begin with on my bet. So once again, these are the best movies of 2015. And number 20 on my list is 99 Homes. I think a really terrific movie. It stars Andrew Garfield, Michael Shannon, and Laura Dern. And in it, Andrew Garfield plays a guy who loses his house because of back payments. Michael Shannon plays this, he's a bastard, who comes in and just takes people's homes from them and has no remorse about it. And in order to, Andrew Garfield is a construction worker who works on houses and rehabbing houses and building houses. And in order to make ends meet, he has to start working for the guy who took the house away from him, played by Michael Shannon. And I don't want to get into what happens if, in case people haven't seen it, but I thought this movie was suspenseful. Like, it plays like a thriller. It's got a really insane opening scene, like another great one. The one take thing has become the single take. That's become like a thing too.
Yeah.
But again, you want to talk about a great opening sequence, a great one take opening sequence in this movie that sets up the entire movie. I thought all the performances were great. I think Michael Shannon's going to get nominated for an Academy Award for this, for supporting actor.
He's right there.
I think it might be Andrew Garfield's best performance. Well, it's his best performance since.
Social Network.
That one and the one Never Let Me Go, which I thought he was tremendous in. Mm-hmm. But everything about this movie, I think the director's great. Is it Ramin?
Ramin Barani?
Yeah. But is it, you pronounce it? Ramin Barani. Yes. Ramin Barani is the director of this movie. And it's subject matter that he's touched on before in his other films. I think this guy's a great filmmaker, and I think 99 Homes is a pretty great movie. That's number 20 on my list. Callan.
My number 20 is a film neither of you guys liked. Spike Lee's Chi-Raq. The kind of insanity that I sort of am down for anytime. It's, you know, his take on the violence in Chicago, but it's done in a very theatrical way that I think was pretty exciting. I think it takes risks. I think it's funny. I think it's strange. I think it's, you know, the kind of movie nobody was expecting when we all heard that Spike Lee was going to make a film about, you know, the South Side of Chicago. We all had the film in our head of what that might be, and this came nowhere close to that film, which I thought was pretty remarkable. It's a movie I'm anxious to see again. It's divisive. A lot of, you know, like I said, I loved it. Nick and Eric didn't like it at all. But, you know, people should go on, you know, Amazon and see for themselves. It's streaming as of a couple days ago, I think.
Okay. And Eric.
Number 20, one of those docs we mentioned, the Kirby Dick's The Hunting Ground, his film about the sort of really has become an epidemic of rape on college campuses towards young women who attend there. And really sort of the systemic institutional problem in really not dealing with it. It's very much a companion piece, and it's just as powerful as The Invisible War, which is his take on rape in the military. And this is an important film. It's one of those docs that is absolutely riveting, heartbreaking, and infuriating. And makes you really want to do something, or at least to raise awareness of this problem, especially considering that he goes no holds barred on someone who's just wrapped up his NFL football season today. So it's an important film that people should take a look at. Most of all of Kirby Dick's films, that Twist of Faith is another film of his that people should take a look at. He's a really great documentarian, and The Hunting Ground is just another notch in his belt.
He's a terrific documentary filmmaker. I go back to Sick, which is one of my favorites, one of my favorite documentaries. And some of the stuff that he captures in that movie is just difficult. Have you guys seen Sick?
No.
Yeah, it's one of those films that I know I should see it.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of afraid.
No, yeah. It's not. It is a movie that I'll never forget.
Yeah.
I've seen it twice, it's like 20 years old, maybe even longer than that. Late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
In that time period I've only seen it a couple of times. Mm-hmm. But it's a tremendous movie, and I've been a fan of his since then. Okay, cool. All right, number 19 on my list of the best movies of the year is The Big Short. The Big Short is Adam McKay, believe it or not. Adam McKay's latest film, the director of Talladega Nights, Anchorman, and The Other Guys. He also co-wrote this movie along with Charles Randolph. And it stars Christian Bale, Steve Carell, Ryan Gosling, and Brad Pitt. And it is essentially, as I'm sure many people know, it's about the collapse of housing and banks in 2008. And these guys who predicted it, knew what was going to happen, and made a crap load of money off the people who lost a lot of money on it. And that's what the movie's about. It is, it's funny. It's infuriating. It's really funny. There's a lot of very, very funny stuff in this movie. It's also accessible. And that's one of the points of the movie is that, you know, when you think, here's a movie about it's about the you know the housing market collapse of 2008. Oh, that'll be thrilling. Especially if you don't like I don't know anything about finances or Wall Street or any of that crap. It's all mumbo jumbo to me. But they know that. Like Adam McKay knew that going in that people would have this, you know, feeling about it. And he made it incredibly accessible. It also helps that he got like a bunch of big stars to be in the movie that would draw people into it. But it's not just that. It's not just that he cast it with big stars who are very likable and very good at what they do. He made a really terrifically entertaining movie that is not only informative but and funny, but also really infuriating and really smart. And just really entertaining, like just a terrifically entertaining movie. So number 19 on my list is The Big Short.
My number 19 is a film that is not open in Chicago yet, and it's called Mustang. This is about this is a film out of Turkey. It opens at the Music Box on January 15th, and it's about five teenage sisters who you know are sort of coming into coming of age, and their parents who are not at all happy with their behavior, and so they kind of take them out of their schools, they lock them in their homes, and they basically, train them to be wives and to be submissive. And it's sort of how these teenage girls cope with that and or escape from it, if they do, in fact, escape. This is a really terrific film. Really, just the performances from the girls are all amazing. And you really are kind of on the edge of your seat during a lot of it. And, and also it's just kind of heartbreaking, too. Like I said, it opens January 15th at the Music Box. And my guess is it'll be in the small theater. Because of what they got going on there right now.
It's not going to be a 70 millimeter. That's
probably not. There's probably not going to be a roadshow.
That's a pretty good bet. Okay, Mustang. Okay, next.
Number 19 on my list is The Walk. Robert Zemeckis' film about Philippe Petit, who in 1974 put a tightrope, a high wire, in between the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center and did a tightrope walk, an illegal tightrope walk, in the early morning hours. And, back when Man on Wire, which is the documentary of this story, came out in 2008, I was very uninterested.
You were also in the minority.
I was in the minority. Yeah. Well, it's not that I didn't like the documentary. It's just I didn't really like the guy so much. And I have a thing about people who put themselves in dangerous situations. Like, I don't care. If I fall is all I care. And I think at the same – while I was watching this, I think Zemeckis sort of felt the same way about this guy in a way, and that he does a very interesting thing in the movie in that he allows this – Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who plays him in the movie, to narrate his own story. And while he's doing the sleight of hand and telling his own story to the audience, Zemeckis is using that as an opportunity to tell a metaphorical tale about his own career. And I think that's where this film sort of elevates from just another version of the story to something far more interesting. And it goes without saying that the last half hour of this film, when he actually pulls the last hour of this film, really, from the heist of getting all the equipment up there to the moment when he first sets foot on the tightrope and the crazy stuff that happens after he takes his first walk across is pretty unforgettable and one of the most breathtaking experiences I had at a theater all year, just clutching the arms, listening to people next to me catch their breath.
Like me?
Like Colin next to me.
You weren't at the same screening I was.
No.
I was making more noise than anybody in the theater.
Very possible.
Yeah.
And I watched again the other night, and my mom had a really fun reaction watching this guy cross the tightrope. She couldn't believe it. And also, she was at the end of the movie, she asked me when this film was made. Because she couldn't believe how they got the Twin Towers so seamlessly put into this entire film. Yeah. She thought this thing was made before 9/11, actually.
Wow.
So Robert Zemeckis continues to be a fantastic craftsman. The Walk is my number 19.
And before we break here, I just want to mention that I did, we received screeners of this. Hmm. And I've said, I'm going to watch it. And man, it worked in my living room too, man. I don't care. Yeah. I mean, you know, watching it in IMAX 3D was mind blowing.
Yes.
And I had to wear Depends during it. But, you know, sitting on my couch watching it in my living room, I was like, and it's still very effective. So I remember when it came out, I was kind of discouraging people from seeing it in non-IMAX or 3D and all that stuff because of the experience. But it's still, well, we'll talk about this one later. let's take a break here. We are doing our best movies of 2015. When we come back, we'll start with 18 and move our way up. It's Colin Suter, Eric Childress, and it is our annual roundup of the best and worst of the year. And we'll do it and come back right after this on 720 WGN. Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we're live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. And we're talking about the best and worst movies of 2015 and other. We have a bunch of subcategories and other things to talk about. Eric Childress, Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com, RogerEbert.com join me. And we've talked about the best documentaries of the year, and many of those are going to be on Eric and Colin's list. And now we are talking about our favorite movies of 2015. What you're hearing is from The Wire, or The Wire. Sorry. The Walk, and that's the score from The Walk, which is number 19 on Eric's list of the best movies of the year. And that brings us to number 18. Welcome back, guys.
Hello.
Number 18 on my list. I'll keep it brief because I know that the two guys in the room are going to have it higher up on their list. But yet, I believe that myself and many people are stunned that I put this at number 18 on my list. It's Star Wars The Force Awakens.
I am stunned.
He did it.
I am stunned.
He put it on his top 20.
And not Furious 7.
Oh, my God.
Stunned.
I didn't think it was going to happen.
I did not see that one coming.
No.
You were right. Genuinely surprised.
Yeah, I thought it was great.
Okay.
But you know what? I'm not even going to talk about it because everybody knows what it is, and these guys are going to talk about it later. So that's number 18 on my list. Yes, all right, damn it. I put it on my top 20 list, all right? Okay, so Star Wars Force Awakens number 18. Yeah, thank you. Slow clap, everybody. Slow clap. You're supposed to have a Letterman's jacket on when you do that.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
And you're supposed to be standing next to a locker.
Luke. Yeah, I was in that movie.
Oh, were you?
Yeah, I was an extra.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I was in Wildcat. My legs were in Wildcats.
All right.
I was off screen in Road to Perdition.
Nice.
There you go.
We are stars. Yeah. All right. Colin, go ahead, man.
All right. So my number 18 doesn't tie in with that film at all in any way. It's a great film. Mississippi Grind, starring Ben Mendelsohn and Ryan Reynolds as a couple of gamblers who go on a road trip together. And Ryan Reynolds is kind of a good luck charm for Ben Mendelsohn, who's kind of very much down on his luck and owes everybody in town a lot of money. This is a really terrific character study for both characters, and I love that Ben Mendelsohn is the star of this film. He's kind of a character actor and gets kind of forgotten a lot, but this is a movie that really is a terrific vehicle for an actor of his type, a terrific performance for him, and really the whole cast is great. Nick has said this before, and it's, I don't want to steal his thunder if he has this on his list too, but it's very true. It's kind of a throwback to sort of an old kind of 70s kind of character study kind of film. Directed by Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck. They wrote...
Half Nelson.
Thank you, Half Nelson.
Yeah, Half Nelson.
I almost said High Tension. Not that film. No.
Wow.
Just those two times. You know, High Tension, Half Nelson.
Get those confused.
I hated that twist in Half Nelson.
Yeah, it was terrible. He was only half.
This is a really a great directing effort by them. And, Mississippi Grind. It's on DVD. People should see it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Number 18, I got another doc, and it's Listen to Me, Marlon. It's a documentary that the filmmakers got a hold of all of these audio tapes that Marlon Brando had recorded over the years, and they use this means to basically tell the story of his life, his ups and downs, and specifically focusing very much on his acting career. Not even so much the career, but the acting itself. This movie is an absolute tribute to the art of acting, and it should be probably required viewing in any film school across the country. So we talked about documentarians finding new ways to tell the story. This was one of the most unique films I saw all year, and I was absolutely riveted by the entire thing. And you gain a whole brand new respect for Marlon Brando. Not that you shouldn't have had it to begin with, but you know, for those who probably just remember his combative ways and his weight issues and those kind of things towards the back half of his career, really give this film a look. It's been playing on Showtime a lot lately, so if you have that, check it out. Any means you have to view this film, I promise you, you'll be absolutely engrossed in it. Listen to me, Marlon.
Terrific, terrific movie. No question about it. Okay, number 17 on my list is one of the bigger surprises for me in terms of how much I really loved it. I saw it again over the weekend, and that's Creed, which is the seventh in the Rocky series.
Yes,
yes. And this tells the story. Michael B. Jordan from The Wire, I might add, plays Apollo Creed's illegitimate son, Adonis, and he's a fighter. He's a kid who grew up in foster homes, and he decides to quit his job after he kind of, you know, finds his wife. Felicia Rashad plays his, not his stepmother, but the wife of Apollo Creed, who gets him out of the foster care system and puts him in the big home that Apollo used to have, and raises him. When he becomes old enough, he wants to be a boxer, so he goes to Philadelphia to look up Rocky Balboa, played by Sylvester Stallone, and asked him to train him. And what inevitably happens is he's possibly going to have this big fight with, a really high-profile fight with this fighter from Liverpool. So much better than I had ever thought it was going to be. Ryan Coogler made this film. He made Fruitvale Station, which is also a really good movie. But this is leaps and bounds better in terms of technique and style. Seeing it a second time, it's just a beautifully directed movie. That first fight scene, man, I can't say enough about the first match in the movie. Beautifully directed and really wonderful. Acting all the way around, story compelling, a wonderful companion piece to the first movie. If you loved the original Rocky, and I don't know anybody who doesn't, if you love the original Rocky, you will love this movie. It is easily the best of the series since Rocky. There are wonderful little homages to Rocky. One of my favorite scores of the year is this one. I think one of the best scores of the year, with little like notes here and there that attribute to the score from the original. I thought this was a great movie. It made me cry a couple of times. I think Stallone is great in this movie, like a truly, really, truly great performance going back to a character that he started playing 40 years ago. More depth than I had ever expected it to have. I was moved by it. I had a great time. My parents thought it kicked ass. I went with my parents this weekend. And the theater was packed, by the way.
Oh, good.
Like, completely packed. And it was as good the second time as it was the first time. One of the biggest surprises for me of the year is Creed at number 17. All right, we have to break. Guys, hang on. We will take a quick break. And when we come back, we will get number 17 from Colin and from Eric. All right, and we will take a quick break here. And this is, we got to do news. Yeah, that's, I ought to look at the clock. Okay, we'll take a quick break. We got the news coming up. More with Eric and Colin. It is the best, the worst, and everything else in between of movies 2015 right here on the Nick DiGilio Show, 720 WGN.
I see it.
I'm not training if you don't get the food. So if I fight you, fight me.
That's what I'm talking about right here. Before the break and before the news, I talked about number 17 on my list of the best movies of the year, and it's Creed. And I talked about how much I love this score. God, I love this score. Colin and Eric are here. We are live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Welcome back, everybody. We're doing our whole movie thing this morning, all the way up to my dad telling a joke. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. The first joke of the new year. And we will also have a Blackhawks Express. And let's get back to the list here, and we'll do a quick recap. And Colin, Eric, welcome back, guys. Okay, so let me give you a quick rundown here of what we've got so far. My number 20 was 99 Homes, 20th best movie of the year. Number 19, The Big Short. Number 18, Star Wars: The Force Awakens. And number 17, Creed. Colin, what were 19 through 18 on your list?
You mean
20 through 18. Okay.
20 is Chirac, 19 Mustang, 18 Mississippi Grind.
Okay. Eric?
My 20 was The Hunting Ground, 19 The Walk, and 18 Listen to Me, Marlon.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on. My 17 is Creed, and Colin, you're 17.
My number 17 was a late entry for my list, kind of altered some things when I saw it 2 days ago. And that is a Western called Bone Tomahawk, which thankfully did not go under my radar, thanks to the enthusiasm of Eric and other critics who also put it in their top of the year list. This is a great Western that, I mean, it's the other great Western with Kurt Russell in it, first of all. There's more than one.
Before you go on, let me just say this. It's you wanted to be, you were stunned that Star Wars made my list. This didn't.
Yeah. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah,
I like the Star Wars movie more than this.
Wow.
Yeah.
So Patrick Wilson, Kurt Russell, Matthew Fox, and Richard Jenkins, four guys who are going after to find the wife of Patrick Wilson, who was kidnapped by some savages. And I mean savages. I really mean savages. I was laughing a lot during this film. The dialogue is so sharp, so fun to listen to. And then by the second half, I was wincing a lot and hiding my eyes a little bit.
And crossing your legs a
crossing
little?
By, yeah. It was
especially
like,
if your name is Nick.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. man, you got to seek this one out. What happened to this film? Why didn't this go anywhere?
I don't know.
Okay.
It makes no sense.
It premiered at Fantastic Fest. You know, I mean, it's got a full cast of stars in it. I mean, tell people this
Kurt
entire
Russell.
Cast.
Okay, Patrick.
Sean
Wilson.
Young.
I can't. Where am I looking at? Okay, David Arquette's in it too.
Richard Jenkins.
I said the cast.
Okay.
Richard Jenkins. Lulu Simmons. Lulu Simmons.
Lily Simmons.
Oh, I can't. The font is so thin on here. I can't read this at all. Matthew Fox, Patrick Wilson, Kurt Russell. It's on DVD. See it. It's great.
It
if you like westerns,
out.
you got to go see this one.
Yeah, it's a terrific movie. Yeah. Terrific movie. Okay. Eric.
Number 17 is Mississippi Grind. Film I saw it at Sundance this year, and I mean there are films about gamblers and there are films about gamblers, and this is a film about the latter. As someone who goes to Vegas and enjoys it very much, I know exactly where the Ben Mendelsohn character is coming from, not in a more pathetic way that he is, but the thrill of the victory and of the loss. This is a film that I think is even better than James Caan's The Gambler, mainly because of the relationship between Ben Mendelsohn and Ryan Reynolds, both of them who I think give career best performances in this movie. Ryan Reynolds, you know, a lot of people like to poke holes at him sometimes for some of his choices.
Because he's a pretty boy, too.
He's a pretty boy, but when he has the right material, he's a really fine actor, and he really is in this movie. Yeah, I mean, it's a character study, and I still wish the film had ended 10 minutes earlier. There's a moment at a blackjack table that I think would have been an absolute perfect ending to this movie, but the 10 minutes that go on past that, there's at least one edit in the last 10 minutes is absolutely hilarious, but it's ultimately incredibly satisfying because of the performances, it's a sharp script. It's a film that understands gambling and its consequences. So a really strong movie. People, again, another one people need to seek out because no one went saw it when it came out. It's called Mississippi Grind.
Right. You'll hear about that one a little bit later. Okay, number 16 on my list, which I know I think is going to be higher on the other gentlemen's lists here, is Room. Room is about a 5-year-old kid and his mother, who have lived, well, he's lived his entire life inside this room, and they've been captive in this room, and they've created this world. At least Brie Larson, who plays the mother, and Jacob Tremblay, who should be mentioned. Among anybody who gave great performances is here. This kid gave, so did Brie Larson, but this kid, he's a kid. He's a little kid,
mm-hmm. 5 years old,
who gave a remarkable performance in this movie. It's about this woman who's been, you know, abused and kept in this room, has a son. The only thing he knows is this room, and they get, and I'm not giving anything away because they talk about it in the trailer. They get out of this room to the real world, and it's about this kid's adjustment. And the mother's adjustment to finally being out of the room and the kid being in the real world. It's based on a book which I've not read. I found the movie to be thrilling. I thought the acting was amazing. I found the first part of the movie to be kind of difficult to watch. It was just kind of difficult to watch. But all the supporting performances in the film, well, actually every performance in this movie is amazing. The supporting performances are really terrific. And it goes in a direction that I didn't think it was going to go in. And it becomes about more than I thought it was going to be about during the first 45 minutes. It also has one of the most gut-wrenching, not gut-wrenching, but, you know, nail-biting sequences, and like an escape sequence that is just astonishingly suspenseful. And that's in the first part of the film as well. So I know we're going to hear about this one later on. But number 16 on my list is Room, okay?
My number 16 is also one we might hear again later on, and it's David Robert Mitchell's It Follows, one of two horror movies that I will be mentioning tonight that don't rely on jump out and scare you moments, but rather rely on tension and mood, atmosphere, and, you know, originality in the storyline. This seems like these 20-somethings who are dealing with some kind of mysterious phantom that's could be following them and, you know, knocking them off if they have sex. It's a very strange premise, but it works. And it's, you know, like I said, gets by on a lot on atmosphere. This director really knows how to craft and to shoot a sequence. Really nice, you know, nice, you know, framing. The score is phenomenal. It's kind of an old fashioned kind of John Carpenter kind of score. And it's just one of the most mesmerizing horror films I've seen in quite a while. It Follows, and it's on DVD. You should see it.
Okay. Eric?
My number 16 is 45 Years. This is a story of Charlotte Rampling and Tom Courtenay play a married couple who are on the verge of celebrating their 45th anniversary. In fact, they're planning this big party around it. When they get the news that his former love, someone that they'd known before Charlotte Rampling, her body has been found. He's known that she's been dead for a long time, but the rediscovery of her body sort of causes this rift in the marriage, and that it's something that he is beginning to think about a lot more. And goes double for Rampling, because now she's sort of figuring that she, for 45 years, she might have just been the second choice of this guy's life. Charlotte Rampling gives the performance of the female performance of the year, as far as I'm concerned. There's not a missed beat in sort of the quiet anger and frustration that's going on between these two characters. Courtenay is really terrific as well. And it ends on the most devastating moment I saw in a movie all year. I had a pit in my stomach that I couldn't shake for hours afterwards seeing it. So it's, again, it's just opening around. I think Rampling's going to get some Oscar consideration, it looks like. And it's one that's, at the very least, check out for her performance, because it's extraordinary.
Didn't make my list, but it's a great movie. And both performances are great. I know Charlotte Rampling is, you know, she's got the money role, and she's magnificent in it. But Courtney's great in this
movie.
He is. It's a great performance all the way around. And a really terrific movie. Again, in any other year, a movie like this would have been like in my top 10, probably. And Charlotte Rampling, it, you know, can't be said enough. She's going to get nominated. There's no question about it. Okay, so that's it. And then we're going to come back. We'll take a break, and we'll come back with our top 15 of the year. So it's Eric, Colin, and me talking about the best, the worst, and everything else movies 2015, and our top 15 movies coming up after we break. Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's our annual big movie year-end roundup, best, worst, everything else, 2015. Colin Suter, Eric Childress join me. We're live in the Allstate studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower. And the music that you are listening to is the great score from Inside Out, which I have no doubt in my mind that we're going to hear about later on as we talk about the best movies. So we are at number 15 now. So 15 on my list is Brooklyn. This is the latest from director John Crowley, who made one of my favorite underrated films, Irish films, called Intermission, which everybody is in who's Irish. And if you've not seen Intermission, you should see it. It's a really a pretty great movie, which is, you know, like tailor-made for me because it's like 27 different characters and 15 different storylines intertwined. It's terrific. But this is a completely different kind of movie than Intermission. It is about an Irish immigrant a girl played by Saoirse Ronan, who moves to Brooklyn, New York from Ireland and tries to start a life while she's there, meets a boy, lives in a boarding house, and then gets called back to Ireland. It's about that that struggle between this new life that she's made in New York and in America and the old life that she left behind and the pull between those two. With a tremendous performance by Saoirse Ronan, who I believe will also be nominated for Best Actress this year. And everybody else involved in this movie is really great. It's a wonderful slice of life movie. I'm sure he'll get mentioned again, but Nick Hornby wrote the screenplay for this movie. And Nick Hornby, not only a great, you know, novelist who has written some really terrific books, and you know, stuff that I really love, but has also become like a really great screenwriter, especially in the world of feminist filmmaking, which seems odd considering how male driven most of his work is. The guy wrote High Fidelity, which is, you know, many young men's Bibles for a Bible for a few years. But he wrote this, and it's great. It's about a strong female character. It's wonderfully shot. It's really entertaining. It's very romantic. And it's just this really great, one of the best coming of age movies I've seen in years, featuring a performance by a girl who's just been, I think, from the get-go, one of the best young actresses ever. And she keeps getting better, and that, I think, is what this movie's about. It's about this girl who's got this, she's great, and you know she's great, and she's going to be greater. And that's what the movie's about. It's this life-affirming film about this really great young person who's discovering new things and will continue to discover more new things and get better. And that's how I feel about Saoirse Ronan as an actress. A great film. So number 15 on my list is Brooklyn. All right, Colin.
My number 15 was a huge surprise for me, and that's Ridley Scott's The Martian. Surprising because I'm not a big Ridley Scott fan, and I'm not used to seeing his movies and feeling anything during them except, wow, that's a really nice shot. This movie actually like moved me and filled me with joy. Maybe I'm just kind of a sucker for movies about space travel. I mean, I love that subject. I love movies about that subject. And The Martian, which is the movie starring Matt Damon as a botanist who gets stranded on Mars after a big storm that, you know, his crew just takes off. They think he's dead. They leave him there, but he's not dead. And he's just trying to communicate with Earth and, you know, tell them that he's still alive. and all the stuff that happens on the ground at NASA with Jeff Daniels and
Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Yes, thank you. All the stuff that
you got to mention Donald Glover,
right? All the stuff that happens on the ground is just as compelling as the stuff that's happening with just Matt Damon's character. This is not just a one-man show kind of film that we've seen a lot of lately, but it's really an ensemble piece. And I had a great time. Second time I watched it, I was like, you know, this really was as good as I remember it, and, you know, even better the second time. So, great. A Ridley Scott movie that I love. I can't remember the last time that happened. So, yeah, The Martian. Okay.
All right, Eric.
Number 15. We have a match.
Oh, wow.
Ridley Scott's The Martian is my number 15. In fact, it leapfrogged from 16 to 15 after I did indeed watch it a second time. At the Toronto Film Festival this year, I saw a lot of really great ensemble pieces. Saw a lot of ensemble pieces. Some of them were great. And this was one of them. And Matt Damon's performance in the movie is terrific. I think there are very few actors that could have pulled off this character in the way that he maintains sort of a good sarcastic humor about his predicament, while really sort of giving the audience what is ultimately sort of a love letter to science. Mm-hmm. And I was not a science guy. I respect science, but I didn't know anything about science. I didn't like science in school, but. You watch this and you kind of just want to root for science. You want to root for scientists and simple things like growing potatoes and things, you know, things that are just, you know, sort of miracles of nature in a way. And the way that like sort of Ron Howard's Apollo 13, you have a lot of people trying to solve problems in order to stay alive. And that really is sort of what life is. So this is a movie about science. It's a movie about life, which are, you know, sort of commingled. It's again, it's a very humorous film that doesn't make it a comedy Golden Globes, but it's a tremendously entertaining film that really doesn't feel like a Ridley Scott film because it's actually full of like hope and optimism and things like that. This film deserved the all the attention it got back in October. So The Martian is my number 15 is 2.
All right. Number 14 on my list is has been mentioned already. It's It Follows, a tremendous, stylish horror film that's really creepy. Like, it's a really creepy movie. I mean, it really is. And David Robert Mitchell is the writer director of this. It's one of the things that I really like about horror movies that work on. It is horror movies that work on different levels, and this one works on a lot of different levels. You know, the target audience for a lot of horror movies are you know, like people in their late teens or early 20s, and that's who the members of this cast are and the characters are. And what do you know? There's a lot of promiscuous sex that happens between people in their late teens and their early 20s, and that's what this movie is about. And it's a, you know. I mean, it's, you know, you have sex with someone and you might die. And I know that this is not an uncommon theme that you find in movies, but it just works on so like a subatomic level. Like you watch it and you're like, oh, God. And I really like the acting in this movie, too. I do want to mention a lot of the performances in this movie are really great. In order to sell this premise, you got to buy into it, and you really do buy into it. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with how grounded the performances are in what is essentially a really ridiculous plot. I can't remember the kid's name who plays sort of the really nerdy guy, but like he ends up being your hero, man, and like on so many levels, he ends up being like the hero of the movie. You guys were talking a little bit about, like, you were talking about 45 years, and I know that we'll be talking about endings of movies. Mm-hmm. This movie has one of one of the craziest endings. Like, the effect that the very final shot of this movie had on me, I was like, what the hell? and I sat there for a couple of minutes, and then I kind of laughed, and I was freaked out by it. And once again, I want to emphasize the score of this movie. This is one of my favorite scores of the year. I mean, this is a throwback, man. You mentioned John Carpenter. All of those late 70s, yeah, early 80s sort of horror thriller movies, I was just like, every time the score popped up, I'm like, yeah, all right, I see where you're going with this. If you're a horror film fan and you haven't seen It Follows, it's a must-see. I mean, it really is. And as you mentioned, Colin, there's another horror movie that came out this year that is probably going to be mentioned as well. And both of them, like, really strong, along with Babadook, the past couple of years, have produced three, I think, of the strongest examples of the horror genre that we've seen in a long time. Okay, we have to break. And then when we come back, we will start with number 14, Colin and Eric, their choices. It's Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN. We're talking about the best, the worst, and everything else for the movies of 2015, and it's our annual show. And we'll come back with more right after this on 720 WGN. All right, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And it is Colin Suter, Eric Childress, and myself doing our annual review of the films of the year. And it's 2015. This is Rey's theme from Star Wars, The Force Awakens, which made my top 20.
Yay.
All right, we are back, and we're talking about our favorite films of the year. We left off at number 14 for me, which was It Follows. So let's hear from Colin Suter. Maybe a quick recap. Yes, let's do that. Quick recap. 20 for me, Nick DiGilio. 20, 99 Homes. 19, Big Short. 18, Star Wars Force Awakens. 17, Creed. 16, Room. 15, Brooklyn. 14, It Follows. Colin, it's 20 through 15.
20, Chirac. 19, Mustang. 18, Mississippi Grind. 17, Bone Tomahawk. 16, It Follows. 15, The Martian.
Number 20, The Hunting Ground. 19, The Walk. 18, Listen to Me, Marlon. 17, Mississippi Grind. 16, 45 Years. And 15, The Martian.
All right. So my 14, obviously, I mentioned, is It Follows. So, Colin, 14 for you.
My number 14 is Love and Mercy. This is the sort of biopic on Brian Wilson, but it only focuses on two points in his life. The one point is him when the Beach Boys recorded Pet Sounds and the recording process of that. And then it jumps ahead, I think, 20, 25 years later. After he's had his breakdown and he meets a girl and wants to start a relationship with her, but he's, you know, sort of being, he's still being looked after by Paul Giamatti's character, who's not a good person at all. This is a really great way to tell, to do a biopic. And, you know, we've had a lot of sort of, you know, music, you know, biopic stories lately, you know, with Get On Up and Straight Outta Compton. Here's one that just, you know, sort of knows the wisdom of, you know, one day can decode an entire life. And this is, you know, I got, you know, just from these two points in his life telling these two stories, I got a full sense of who Brian Wilson was. More so than I think I would have gotten it if they had done a straight up, you know, cradle to present day kind of film. Great performances from Paul Dano and John Cusack. Cusack, I think, had a great year this year. You know, he's been kind of slumping, you know, over the past few years. But I think with this and Chirac.
Maps of the Stars.
And Maps of the Stars.
Or not.
I think Cusack, you know, I think did a great job this year, and he's, I think he's great here. What are the chances of this being remembered at Oscar time?
I think Paul Dano has a chance.
Okay, in supporting,
yes.
Okay, but you know what? This is a really great biopic. I love all the Pet Sounds stuff, especially. I'm a, you know, production recording geek, so I love seeing, you know, the making of that. Even if it, you know, even if it was parodied in Walk Hard, that's still funny. It's still cool to watch. So yeah, Love and Mercy, really great movie.
I really enjoyed that movie. Didn't make my list, but I really like that movie. And I think I actually think that Cusack's terrific in it.
Yeah.
Really terrific. Chirac, not so much, but I loved him in Maps to the Stars. I thought he was great, too. All right, Eric?
Number 14 on my list is Brooklyn, a film that I got to very late this year. Played at Sundance. I didn't see it. We reviewed it on the show. I hadn't seen it yet. And then I finally got around to it during screener award season. And more than probably any film this year, this one really sort of fit like just a warm blanket. You know, watching the way the story unfolded, you know, through the eyes of just a really just warm, beautiful, extraordinary performance by Saoirse Ronan. It's a movie that's very easy to fall in love with, and I don't mean that, you know, facetiously at all. Even though there was about a 20-minute portion of this film where I kind of hated the direction she was going into.
You were rooting for the other guy, man.
I was. Emery Cohen rules in this movie, okay? And well, she could have let the other guy know that there was a guy back. I don't want to get into it. I was screaming obscenities at the television, like you. But then it completely all turns around. She makes the right decision, and the final like moment of the movie is so beautiful. And it's like our colleague Sergio Mims sort of commented that watching this movie, you sort of see Saoirse Ronan go from a girl to a woman in just under 2 hours. And that's a remarkable performance. And just sort of like what we saw with what we kind of see with Rey in Star Wars The Force Awakens, we see the journey of this young girl in a very, very positive manner, in a very strong way. That we see this person grow up and becomes the confident, protagonist by the end of the movie. That she's not just the girl, she's the woman.
Right.
So it's a beautiful movie.
No, as I mentioned before, that's how I feel about it. It's a career bridge for her.
Yes.
It's like she played girl roles.
Yeah.
She's a woman now. And you see it happen within the movie, within the character, and with her as an actor.
And she's been trying to find the right role for years. I mean, she was in The Lovely Bones, which she's extraordinary. She's the best thing about that movie, very flawed movie. But then, in between, Hannah's really good. People should check out Hannah if they haven't seen it. But there have been just roles in between that just haven't matched her talent.
Yep.
And this one absolutely does, and this is the one that's going to propel her.
No, there's no question about it. No question about it. Okay, so that was number 4. Number 13 on my list. I know we're going to hear from again here, and I think you guys probably think I have it too low on the list, but Spotlight is number 13 on my list. This, of course, everybody's heard about this one. This is the story of the Boston Globe in the early 2001 is when it happened, where they kind of uncovered the child molestation scandal within the Catholic Church, which is a pretty big deal in Boston. Well, it's a pretty big deal anywhere, but especially in Boston. And it's about this group of journalists who work for the Globe, who call themselves Spotlight, and are working together to get the story out. Remarkable cast in this movie. To talk about the cast of this movie is just insane. And everybody in it is tremendous. You got Mark Ruffalo, who I think would be the lead.
I think everyone is supporting in this movie because it's such an ensemble piece.
Yeah, and you've got Michael Keaton, Rachel McAdams, Liev Schreiber, John Slattery, Brian D'Arcy James, Stanley Tucci, and everybody in it is tremendous. It's a remarkably suspenseful film that has no flash to it, and I mean that as a compliment. I rewatched Spotlight not too long ago, and then I a couple of days later, I popped in Shattered Glass, which is one of my favorite movies ever made about journalism, and they both have that same sort of thing. It's not about the fireworks. It's about digging in and creating characters based on their work and what they're doing and how they feel about their work. And ultimately, especially in this day and age, with journalism just being blurred now and the news, you don't know what, Eric and I happen to be massive fans of South Park, and they had a pretty extraordinary season this year. Well, a remarkable, in my opinion, a remarkable season. But one of the strong things that they did was to rip apart what people think is news nowadays. Like, if you get your news online, you're not getting news. You know, there is a really strong chance that you're getting a bunch of BS. And Trey Parker did an incredible, insane job doing that. This movie's testament to a time where that was changing, because it takes place in 2001.
Yep.
It's on the cusp of becoming what it is now,
yeah,
and yet that's what these people were holding on to. And that's one of the reasons why I love this movie as much. I think it ranks up there. You know, in, if you want to watch great films about journalism, the I mean, the gold standard, in my opinion, is All the President's Men. Shattered Glass in this. And this is a tremendous movie, and I know we're going to hear more about it as we go on. But number 13 on my list is Spotlight.
My number 13 is Listen to Me, Marlon, which we've mentioned already. This is a documentary about Marlon Brando, all told in his words, which is, I think, the greatest thing about it is that it's not, it doesn't waste time with, you know, talking head interviews of people who knew him and all that. This is just, you know, from the man himself. And, you know, it's a pretty remarkable thing that they could, you know, put this movie together. I mean, thank God he recorded all that too. But it's a pretty remarkable thing about, you know, about acting, about how, you know, Hollywood went from this old acting style to, and then how Brando changed it. And then the movie is bookended by this, him predicting sort of the digital age and what's to come. And he was right, essentially. And it's a pretty great way to sort of make Marlon Brando's, you know, career, his life, that much more relevant to today's actors. Definitely, like Eric said, every actor should watch this film. It should be required viewing. And, yeah, Listen to Me, Marlon, one of the very best documentaries of the year.
Okay.
13 is Creed on my list. It's as remarkable a surprise as you had in the theater, Nick. And this is a movie that, you know, I'm a big fan of Rocky Balboa.
I am too.
You know, and I think that, you know, I mean, I think that there's more to the Rocky series than just the, sort of the goofy memories that we have. I think Stallone did an interview with on Robert Rodriguez's show. I don't know if you saw that or not.
Director's Chair?
Yeah, Director's Chair. He did one.
Oh, Stallone did one?
Did
oh,
one.
No. I didn't see it.
Yeah. And he basically talks about why he did the Rocky movies the way they did. I mean, yeah, there was obviously profit involved, but he was trying to do interesting things with the character. And I think that when you go back and you see that how much he loves this character, that you can go back and you can watch all the Rocky movies and just watch him and just watch what he's done with this character over 40 years and culminates in this remarkable supporting performance as his mentor, as sort of the spirit guide of this entire story. And, you know, I mean, I don't want to, you know, downplay Michael B. Jordan or Tessa Thompson or any of the supporting work. Michael B. Jordan's the star of the movie. All of them are terrific. This is a movie that doesn't half-ass anything. You know, they tell a story. It's over 2 hours long. And they don't half-ass the relationship with the girlfriend. They particularly don't half-ass the moment when Rocky gets sick, which people know from the trailer. To go through and really it sort of follows Stallone's mantra that he started with Rocky, sort of brought even more weight with Rocky Balboa, and sort of finishes here in that, you know, life is worth fighting for, and just, you know, you're just constantly fighting and talking yourself out of the worst predicaments, and this movie is really a testament to that. And at least Michael B. Jordan, the fight sequences in the movie are terrific. Ryan Coogler really elevates himself from just you know, from what he did with Fruitvale Station. It's an incredibly entertaining film that I think is going to resonate more and more with people who get to see it over the years, the way the original Rocky did for some people.
You know, people seem to forget, because the Rocky movies got so silly. But they forget. If you go back and watch that first movie, that movie is not a quote-unquote Rocky movie or how the Rocky movies became.
Right.
You know, by the time Rocky V came out, it was a joke.
Right.
But that first movie is a movie of its time period. That's a 70s movie. That's a movie that, you know, I mean, Alvinson's the director of that movie, but that movie could have been directed by any of the, you know, of the guys that were doing that kind of aesthetic.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's a slow-moving film. It's deliberately paced. It has an improvisational feel to it. And it's about characters more than anything else. He loses the fight at the end. People forget that. You know, people, oh, Rocky, it's all about him, the underdog. He loses the fight at the end of that movie.
But and people also, the fact that it's kind of nonchalant in a way because he's hitting his high point in another way at the end of that fight.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, so people remember that, and the fight, it doesn't even matter. It's the fact that he went the distance, and that's the entire point.
And that's the point of this
character.
Movie. Yes. And that's the point of this movie.
Absolutely.
And it hasn't really been about that. Even Rocky Balboa, that's not the point. And I mean, in Rocky Balboa, I really like mm-hmm. that film. But this one, to me, was made by a bunch of people who clearly were affected by and love the original Rocky.
Yes.
And I had the incredible experience of sitting next to Mike View, mm-hmm. Watching this movie the first time,
yeah.
who Rocky is his, that's the greatest movie ever made, and he was losing his mind. And I don't know, I expected more from this movie at the box office. I really did. It did solid numbers.
It did very solid numbers. I expected it more, too.
Me
after
too.
The response of the opening weekend, I thought it was going to... It dropped off a little quicker than I thought it did, but still did $100 million. So
yeah,
it's still
and I just saw it. I just saw it. Like I said, I saw it like 48 hours ago, and the theater was packed on a Saturday evening, and the audience went nuts.
Yeah.
And it's a terrific film, and you know, and when we get into surprises a little bit later on, I think I've gave mine away.
Yeah,
it's not a surprise anymore. All right, Colin, Eric, hang on. All right, when we come back, we will go into our top 12 of the movies. Feel like I'm at the music box with the lights dimming on the day after Christmas. And then a few days later. this is the awesome score by Ennio Morricone for Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight. We're going to talk about that one a little bit. Eric and Colin are here. We're doing our movies of the year, the best and worst. Right now we're in the middle of our best. Let's go to number 12. This is number 12 on my best list. Number 12 on my best list. By the way, welcome back, guys.
Hello. Yeah, thank you.
All right, number 12 on my best list is Queen of Earth. I love this movie. For me, I know you said Charlotte Rampling. Mm. For me, it's all about Elizabeth Moss, man.
Yeah.
this is a very unsettling, to say the least, very unsettling movie about a girl who's basically having like a breakdown. It gets dumped, goes to her childhood friend's lake house, and they're going to spend a relaxing time together at the lake house. And that just doesn't happen because she's like kind of gone off the deep end. Alex Ross Perry wrote and directed this movie. We were talking a little bit earlier about how Creed reflects what the movie Rocky felt like in the 70s. This movie is a blatant throwback to, you know, your movies of the 70s as well, or late 60s, Rosemary's Babies and these other movies that have that sort of spirit to it. It's a strange movie. Anybody who thought that Patrick Fugit was adorable and almost famous, that goes right out the window in this film. I really love this movie on many, many levels, but it's mostly because of Elizabeth Moss. This is a remarkable performance and a draining performance and a brave performance and a strange performance. I can't take my eyes off of her in this movie. It's hypnotic watching her in this film. And I think everything about the movie is really strong and terrific. And this one is... psychological thriller, but I think it could fall under that heading of horror. I mean, if you're going to include movies like, you know, Rosemary's Baby and The Tenant, clearly he likes Polanski, this director, but if those movies fall under that umbrella, I think this one does too. But you know, to me, the most astoundingly hypnotic performance of the year came from Elizabeth Moss in Queen of Earth, which I love this movie. Okay, that's number 12, Colin.
My number 12 is a great science fiction film called Ex Machina. This is a debut film for
number
Alex.
21 on my list.
Yeah. This is a debut film from Alex Garland, and it signals a really remarkable talent. Oscar Isaac, Alicia Vikander, and Domhnall Gleeson. Oscar Isaac is this, you know, sort of...
What a good year this guy's had.
Oh, man.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. A sort of reclusive Bill Gates, Steve Jobs type who invites Domhnall Gleeson to his... to his ranch or whatever it is. It's like middle of nowhere to sort of help him with introduce him to his little artificial intelligence creation played by Alicia Vikander.
And another good year.
Another good year. So these so it becomes a kind of a great film about artificial intelligence, as well as the male fantasy gone sour, which is also a favorite theme of mine. And this is a really smart. This is what science fiction is all about. It's all, you know, it's smart, it's brainy, it takes something that is, you know, is improbable but not that improbable, and really causes you to, you know, have some really interesting conversations when it's over. Some people are infuriated by the ending. I think the ending's great. Just dark and just kind of nasty, but perfect and so appropriate. Okay. So Ex Machina.
Okay, Eric?
Number 12 on my list. I'll pose this question to you guys. What is more surprising, that Nick had Star Wars in his top 20 or that I have a Spielberg film out of the top 10?
Wow!
Okay, well, number 12 on my list is Bridge of Spies,
yeah.
Which is Spielberg's film about the Cold War and the sort of the trading of spies between America and Russia with Francis Gary Powers. Tom Hanks is a real badass performance in this movie, a film that could have been incredibly dry and very Cold War-y, but really has a really sharp script that's co-written by the Coen brothers, and a lot of scenes have their absolute flavor to them. Mark Rylance, as the Russian spy, is going to get nominated. The script, I believe, is going to get nominated as well. The denseness of the story, and particularly when this film does transfer to Berlin and the negotiations begin to take place, this movie really, really comes alive. Could have done without the last 2 minutes of the movie, but Bridge of Spies, another really great work from Mr. Spielberg.
All right, we're going to break here. We got the news coming up right here, and when we come back, we will do our top 11. We will also fly through the worst movies of the year and talk about our subcategories. All of that right here after the news on 720 WGN. Morning, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's a Monday morning. I love this score so much. This is from the movie It Follows. Such a great score. Eric Childress, Colin Suter, and I get together every year, and we talk about the best and worst and everything else movie-wise. We're running out of time here, so we're not going to recap, but we're at number 11 on our best movie list. And we want to get to you as much as here as possible. So we're just going to jump right into it. We're at number 11. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, my number 11 on the list is Good Night, Mommy, which is just a fun movie. It's about these two twin boys whose mother goes off to get some sort of like facial surgery, reconstructive surgery, and she comes back covered in bandages. And her behavior is different, so they begin to think that she might not be their mom. And then they do some stuff. here's the thing I want to say about this movie. It's incredibly creepy, skin crawling, and friggin' awesome. But I do want to say this. Everybody is kind of like, they talk about that there's this big twist in it. I've seen this movie three times, and I am convinced that it's not a twist. I'm convinced that the filmmakers know that they're not pulling the wool over anybody's eyes. I don't think of it like it's supposed to be this big reveal. I don't even think there is a reveal. I think that from the opening shots of this movie, it seems obvious to me. And I know that it seems obvious to a lot of people, but everybody seems to say, yeah, the twist, I saw it really early on. And I think you saw it really early on because you were meant to see it really early on. I don't think it's a flaw. I love this movie. I really do. It's not for everybody. As I've mentioned before, the second time I saw it in the theater, there were a group of people that were sitting at the music box. There were a group of people who were sitting across the aisle from me a couple of rows back. And there was a guy who the entire movie, when certain things would happen, he'd just go, oh, hell no. it would be like 5 minutes. No, oh, hell no. So I heard, oh, hell no. While I was leaving, yeah. Hell no, when the movie was over. Oh, hell no. So it gets that kind of reaction out of people. I love this movie. It'll make your skin crawl, but it's pretty remarkable. So Good Night, Mommy, number 11 on my list. Colin.
My number 11 is The End of the Tour, James Ponsoldt's really terrific
See, another
film.
One that would have made my list any other
25,
year.
25.
Damn. Really terrific film about David Foster Wallace and a reporter from Rolling Stone doing a story on his book tour. And just, it's a great film. It's also a great movie about journalism along with Spotlight, but it's also a great film about writing in general. And you don't have to know anything about David Foster Wallace. I didn't know anything. I've never read any of his stuff.
I know I should.
But Jason Segel just gives a really career-changing performance for him. Really one of the best of the year. And, End of the Tour.
End of the Tour. All right.
Yeah. Okay. Number 11 on my list, you know, there are some action franchises that get better over time. This one is certainly the real deal. And if it wasn't for Mad Max Fury Road, this would be the best action film of the year. And I'm talking about Mission Impossible: Rogue Nation. It's incredible that this, you know, I thought Ghost Protocol was going to be like a peak, and that they were going to, you know, ride that for a while, and it was just going to kind of go back down. But Christopher McQuarrie really did some extraordinary action sequences in this movie. A film that beat Spectre, which has the same plot,
yep.
Beat it by several months, and is a far better film. The action sequences in this movie are incredible. The camaraderie between the cast is great. Rebecca Ferguson is a great addition. I'm really glad that they're going to bring her back for number six. Christopher McQuarrie, man, I mean, he's more than just a writer. He's clearly, you know, Jack Reacher is a kind of an underrated Tom Cruise vehicle as well. And
I went back and I watched The Way of the Gun.
Yeah.
I liked it a lot more. The first time I didn't like it very much.
Yeah.
It's a lot better than I thought it was.
It's really good.
Yeah.
But I think this is the best thing he's done directorially. And I can't wait. I really hope that he's going to be involved with the next one because this was pretty special.
Okay. All right. Here we go. Top 10 of the year. Good Lord. I don't know what you guys think of this movie. We have not spoken. My number 10 is Joy, David O. Russell's latest movie. And I loved this movie. And I went in not knowing much about it. I knew that, like, you know, his core group of actors that he now continues to work with on a regular basis. Jennifer Lawrence is the lead. Robert De Niro plays her dad. Bradley Cooper shows up, are in this movie, and I wasn't really sure about this. I mean, it didn't seem to get as much hype as David O. Russell's movies of the past 4 or 5 years have. But it's this great story, based on a true story, about this woman who is sort of cursed to be a failure. She comes from a very weird family, which includes some performances. Virginia Madsen in this movie, who plays her mother in the movie. I adore her in this movie. I think she's just great. Diane Ladd, who is the voice from the movie, she's like the narrator of the film, plays her grandmother, and she wants desperately. Jennifer Lawrence wants desperately to succeed, but family obligations and fate. And crappy relationships and really horrible things that happened to her have got her stuck in these dead-end jobs that she has to take care of her family. She's got an ex-husband. She's got a couple of kids. And But she always has these ideas. She wants to come up with patents, and she comes up with this idea. It's based on a true story of the mop that you can squeegee without touching it. And it becomes, you know, and that's what the movie's about. Now, if you're not David O. Russell and you don't have Jennifer Lawrence, Bradley Cooper, and Robert De Niro in your cast, you're not going to get this movie made. Yeah, I got this movie. It's about this girl. She's a loser, but she comes up with the idea for this mop. Thank you. Get out is what most. But he pulls it off. It's to me, it seems like two different movies, and we haven't really talked about this. The first half of the movie is this wonderful David O. Russell dysfunctional family movie, which he's really strong at. Weird characters and strange laughs and wonderful characterizations. And then the second half of this movie becomes like this. Like, as soon as Bradley Cooper enters, it becomes a second movie. It becomes a different movie. And it becomes this movie about about corporations and television. The quirkiness is still there, but on a different level. And I love these two movies, and somehow they mesh. I don't know how this movie works. I don't know how he got it made. I was like, oh my god, this was fantastic. And I know it did strong business the first weekend. I know it's not doing that well now. I loved this movie. And again, Jennifer Lawrence, man, she is the real deal. And De Niro has this. De Niro's great in this movie, and as is everybody. Edgar Ramirez, by the way, who plays her ex-husband, another great sort of relationship weird, this David O. Russell kind of weird relationship thing is fantastic. But De Niro has this toast that he gives at the wedding, which is one of the funniest things De Niro has ever done. He ends up with salad all over his shoulder at one point. I don't even get into it. But I love this movie, and I think it's aptly titled. It's called Joy. I just thought it was great. And I've often loved, you know, I always loved David O. Russell. But now, I mean, it's gotten to the point where it's like every movie this guy makes is going to be good. All right, so that's my number 10. All right, Colin?
My number 10 is your number 11, Good Night, Mommy. I agree. The twist is not the point of the film. I saw the twist. I saw the, you know, reveal coming 5 minutes in. Also, I still love the film because it's not about the twist. It's about other things. And, yeah, creepy as hell. You know, proceed with caution with this one.
Number 10 on my list is the other science fiction movie with Oscar Isaac and Domhnall Gleeson, and that's Star Wars The Force Awakens.
Ooh, only 10?
Yeah, number what? 10 on my list.
Oh, man.
This is even more shocking to you.
Yeah.
But no, I found room for it on my number 10 because it is, you know, as joyful experience as I had in a movie all year. I've seen it 3 times now in all available formats, and it's also a throwback to the original 1977 film, and that's one of its strengths. You know, calling it just a copy or just, you know, pointing out just like, well, that's the same as the other movie. Well, all the movies are kind of the same as the original movie. That's not something new, so get over it. And it's joyous, it's exciting, it's really funny, it's shocking, and it ends on a wonderful moment of hope. Some would say new hope. And also a cliffhanger, and it just makes you sit there just like, please give me episode 8 right now. I cannot wait what Rian Johnson is going to do with the next one. Star Wars is back, ladies and gentlemen, as number 10.
All right, we'll take a break. Colin and Eric are here. We've got 9 more movies to talk about for our best list, and we're going to come back after that, right after we take this break. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trip Tower. That is music from a documentary called The Hunting Ground, which appeared on, my list for the best documentaries of the year. And, Eric, it was on your list.
And my number 20.
And mine who?
And Colin's list. So, good movie, obviously. All right, Eric and Colin are here, and we are into our top 10. And my number 9 is where we're at now. My number 9 is Anomalisa. Anomalisa is the latest film from Charlie Kaufman. Duke Johnson co-directed it. It's an animated film. It's very difficult to describe this movie. It is about a man who goes on a business trip Like I said, it's all animated. He goes on a business trip and he meets this girl at this conference that he's going to speak at. And he's the author of this book. And before he meets this girl, Anomalisa, he hooks up, not hooks up, but meets with an ex-girlfriend whom he dumped years earlier. They have like a drink and they have some dinner, and that goes south. He gets loaded. He takes a little walk to a different, a little toy shop, makes a little brief stop at his toy shop. By the way, the toy shop is called Dino's, which is named after Dino Stamponopoulos, who played Starburns.
Community.
And produced this movie.
Oh.
So Dino, who's from Chicago, went to Columbia College. So he goes to Dino's toy shop, and again, he looks around. He's drunk. And when he comes back, he meets these two women who are in this hallway. One of them is very unique, and he takes a liking to her. And it's about this one-night relationship that they have. Okay. It's very hard to talk about this movie. For many, many reasons, and I don't want to give away, David Thewlis, Jennifer Jason Leigh, and Tom Noonan are the main voices in the movie. I don't want to give anything away about the film. I have a very specific vision as to what I thought happened, and I still think happens, and I'll tell you guys off the air as to what I actually think really happened within the world of this movie.
Okay.
I found it moving. I found it sad, profoundly weird. It's Charlie Kaufman, so it's going to be weird. To me, I think it's the best thing he's written since Adaptation. I went a little bit bonkers over this movie. I was really kind of overwhelmed by how crazy and weird and beautiful and moving it was. It's a deeply moving film. So Anomalisa is number 9.
My number 9 is Cartel Land, our pick for Best Documentary of the Year, Nick and I's pick. This is a documentary about the cartels in Mexico and how they, terrorize basically the whole everywhere. And basically the footage that this documentarian got is remarkable and scary and full of tension and full of characters who are really fascinating and interesting to follow through this whole story about how some of these villages what they can to sort of rise up against these cartels and what happens in the aftermath of that. It's also about the U.S. Border Patrol as well. It does not come away with any easy answers. It poses a lot of difficult questions. It doesn't come with any easy answers. It's not a documentary that is, meant to sway you one direction or the other as to what can be done about all this. Like a lot of documentaries, like the best documentaries, it challenges the viewer rather than tells you what to think. And I find that much more interesting than, say, a Michael Moore film. Cartel Land, I believe it's on DVD right now. You should definitely check it out.
Great film.
A really remarkable experience.
Great film. Okay, 9 on your list, Eric.
9 on my list is a film that very few people have seen, and it's a movie called Spring. And I saw this at the Toronto Film Festival in 2014. It came out this March. It's been aptly described as Before Sunset with a Monster. And that's an apt description, but at the same time, it doesn't give credit to both halves of that description. Because Lou Taylor Pucci plays a guy whose family has all just passed away. He ends up going to Italy just to try and get away from his pain and whatnot. And he ends up meeting this young woman played by Nadia Hilker. He's a decent guy, and he tries to form a relationship with her, which he eventually does. But she's carrying a secret. She is this sort of odd creature that the less you know about it, the better. It's a film that takes both halves of its movie seriously. It's not a romance that is an excuse to have a creature in it, or is it just a creature film and then they just kind of rush the romance? They take both halves of this movie very seriously, and the chemistry between the two of them is terrific. I think it's the best thing Lou Taylor Pucci's ever done. And then when it gets to actually becomes a monster movie, it doesn't throw away the relationship aspect of it. It actually delves into a sort of a new mythos of a creature that we have never really seen before. And it's funny at times, and the two of them are terrific. And this movie went to unexpected places that I just really just completely engaged me. And again, not many people saw this movie. It's definitely a sleeper out there that people need to check out. It's called Spring.
Okay. All right. Number eight on my list has been mentioned by both gentlemen here, Mississippi Grind, which you guys covered beautifully. Great throwback to films of the 70s. California Split has been mentioned in this. It's the best movie that Alexander Payne didn't make this year. Loved it. Performance is incredible. Ben Mendelsohn and Ryan Reynolds are both great in it. And I didn't really have a problem. It could have ended at that blackjack scene, but it didn't, and I was fine with it because it went on longer.
Mm-hmm.
Loved it. Mississippi Grind, number eight.
My number eight has also been mentioned by you guys, and that's Brooklyn. Really, I mean, just a beautiful film with a beautiful central performance, and, you know, just one of those movies that I just think is going to – I think this is probably going to have a lot of Oscar – I mean, I could kind of see this one being a front runner for, like, Best Picture. I just kind of a mild prediction there, but
it's going to get nominated.
Yeah, I'm sure it will be. So that's my number eight.
Okay.
All right.
My number eight was mentioned by Nick earlier, and it's Adam McKay's The Big Short. You know, we've had some movies that have tried to cover this territory before. Some have skirted around it, like Margin Call, and then there was Too Big to Fail on HBO. Both films I found very dry. Margin Call I don't really like at all. Too Big to Fail is very – it's the kind of movie that Adam McKay knew you thought you were going to see when going into this and crafted something – completely different. It's one of the funniest movies you'll leave angry at of the year, probably the most. And the cast is terrific. Carell, Bale, Gosling, and Pitt, they're all really good. So, again, another great ensemble piece. Big Short is my number eight.
Okay. Number seven on my list is Inside Out, Disney Pixar's film that came out this summer. And it's about the emotions that are inside your head, and it basically covers it's from the mind of this little girl Riley, who we see from birth, and the emotions that are in her head that are voiced by Amy Poehler, who plays Joy, and then sadness is played by Phyllis Smith from The Office, and fear is Bill Hader. And anger is played by Lewis Black. Disgust is Mindy Kaling. And then Richard Kind shows up as this character called Bing Bong. So it's just great. It's one of my favorite Pixar movies in the past bunch of years. I just love this movie, but I know we're going to hear more about it. So we're going to break here. When we come back, we'll get Colin, we'll get Eric's top seven movies, and then we'll tell you the best movies of the year, the best movie of the year, in our opinion, the worst movies of the year, and we got some topics to talk about as well. All right, we'll take a quick break here on 720 WGN. All right, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody, and we've been talking about our favorite movies of the year, and let's get right back to it. Colin and Eric are here. Number six on your best list, number seven on your best list, Colin.
My number seven is a really unconventional thing, but I did it anyway, and it's a short film called World of Tomorrow by Don Hertzfeldt, and, you know, short films has kind of become my niche in the last few years. This is a film I've watched more than any other film this year. It sort of had a theatrical run. It played in an animation festival that toured the country. And is one of the greatest, most unique, most beautiful, most hilarious things I've ever seen. It's animated. You can watch it on Vimeo. And I highly recommend you do if you want to see just a crazy, funny science fiction film that is beautiful and just one of the best things I've seen
year. It is great. All right, Eric?
Number seven is my favorite documentary of the year, and that's Bobcat Goldthwait's Call Me Lucky. His tribute to his friend, comedian Barry Crimmins, who was a bit of a legend in the Boston comedy community, and then went through some personal trauma that the film takes a shift about midway through and begins to talk about in fantastic and graphic detail. It's great to have, just, you know, Barry Crimmins is a comedian I remembered from the 80s, and to see where he's kind of gone from to become a sort of political humorist and especially an activist for basically, you know, what the spotlight is about. It's an important film. It's a fascinating film, a harrowing film, but also a very funny film. And Bobcat Goldthwait, God bless him, and Barry Crimmins for making this film possible.
Got it. All right, we're up to number six. Number six on my best list is the movie that destroyed me emotionally more than any movie this year, and that's James White. This small, ultra-low-budget movie directed by Josh Mond. In it, Christopher Abbott, who I think gives one of the best performances of the year, plays this 20-something sort of self-destructive guy who has to face up to responsibilities in his life, one being that the fact that his mother, played by Cynthia Nixon, has cancer. Not the happiest, well, not remotely happy in any way, but just really profoundly moving. Number six on my list. I love this movie called James White. Next.
My number six is one that Eric mentioned already, and that's 45 Years. And I agree, Charlotte Rampling is the one I'm rooting for Best Actress the most, and I think it's the best movie Mike Lee never made.
Interesting. Okay. Six on your list, Eric.
Six is the movie that I saw on the same day that I saw James White at Sundance, and that's Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
I can't even imagine that.
And, I saw this after James White. But this one, thankfully, was a bit funnier. It's a coming-of-age story about a kid who is sort of coerced into becoming to befriending the girl down the street who has a lymphoma. And they become friends, and he's sort of an amateur filmmaker. He does some really weird takes on actual movies and makes short films himself. It's a wonderful coming of age story about trying to be invisible in high school, just trying to close off all your emotions. And this is about a kid that is then forced to confront those very emotions. It's a beautiful, funny, heartbreaking film. Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
Okay, my number five is White God, which is an astounding movie on so many levels. It's a futuristic, I guess, about a place where there's a severe tax and dogs have been banned, and they get rid of this kid. They get rid of her dog, and the dog. It's like, here's the best way to describe it as quickly as I can. It's like Rise of the Planet of the Apes, but with real dogs. But with real dogs is what I'm saying. And that's what's astounding about this movie. It's an incredibly well-made movie with some sequences that are just mind-boggling and jaw-dropping as to how they got these things and how these are dogs. They're real dogs. And you watch certain sequences in your movie and you're like, how the hell? What? So White God is number five on my list.
All right, my number five is Star Wars, The Force Awakens. All right, I'm not going to apologize for it, but putting above all these other serious movies, I go to the movies not just to be intellectually stimulated, but to have fun as well. And Star Wars delivered the fun in massive amounts. It was worth the wait. It was worth the anticipation. It was worth all that stuff. I had a great time. I love it.
Okay.
Star Wars.
Number five on my list is a film that kind of devastated me emotionally, and that's Room. Brie Larson is terrific. Nick talked about it. I can't say anything more. I will say more about Jacob Tremblay, who I think gives the best male performance of the year. And he's only 7-8 years old whenever he made this movie. He plays a 5-year-old in the movie. Has the suspense sequence, the escape sequence just destroyed me. There are moments in this movie that teared me up just instantaneously. It was like the characters from Inside Out were just having a battle in my head while I was watching this thing. It's a fantastic piece of work by Lenny Abramson. The Room.
Okay. Number four on my list, and I don't give a damn, is The Walk. Robert Zemeckis' remarkable, remarkable movie, and you mentioned it earlier. Everybody knows what it's about. Everybody should see it. And it is a parable about filmmaking. And look at it on that level. Zemeckis continues to be one of the greatest American filmmakers alive, and this is like a culmination of greatness. I loved The Walk. That's number four. Okay?
My number four is Room, which Eric just talked about, and it's a pretty remarkable emotionally movie. Hits you on an emotional level that I wasn't expecting considering it's from the director of Frank. So
yeah, okay.
A great movie about parenting too, I should say. I mean, it's a real great movie about parenting.
Yeah.
Number four on my list is Steve Jobs, Danny Boyle's and Aaron Sorkin's pseudo biopic about the Apple the Apple guy, for lack of a better term. To me, this movie. It's played like a three-act structure with it, like a play in a way. And to me, the movie that this movie sort of shares a lot in common with, I think, is shameless plug, All That Jazz.
Hey!
In a way that you might be able to see this week.
You might be able to see it Tuesday.
Yeah, because the way I sort of view this film is beyond the extraordinary writing and the performances is that this is sort of Steve Jobs in sort of purgatory, looking back at the people that he's wronged over time and sometimes making amends, sometimes most of the time not making amends, not apologizing for who he was and what he did. That's the way I view the film, and I think the film is pretty extraordinary.
Okay. Number three on my list is The Revenant, which is Alejandro González Iñárritu's survival film based on true story about a frontiersman played by Leonardo DiCaprio, who's mauled by a bear, left for dead by Tom Hardy, and survives to get back to Tom Hardy. An incredible movie, not an easy movie to watch, but it, again, insanely well made, and there is a sequence in this movie that I still can't believe exists. But it's The Revenant, number three. Okay,
My number three is Spotlight. Is that yours too?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Ah, look at that!
I just have a love letter to journalism.
I have a feeling about our top three here. I have a feeling there's not gonna be too many surprises here. So, yeah, Spotlight, great movie about journalism. Go see it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Number
that's
three,
yours
Spotlight.
Too. All right. Number two on my list is The Hateful Eight, Quentin Tarantino's latest. I don't think that everybody's going to get a chance to see it in 70mm, but that's the way to see it. I think it's Tarantino's best movie. Might be my favorite Tarantino movie. I'm not kidding. Might be my favorite Tarantino movie of all time. I've seen it twice, and everybody, a lot of people's complaints about the length. I don't find it lengthy at all. I think it's funny. I think it's dark. I love the gore. All the acting is great in it. Any time when you give a showcase to Walton Goggins like he gets in this movie, it's a damn good thing. I loved Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight. Loved it. One of my favorite movie experiences of the year, by the way, was seeing that at the Music Box in 70mm. Number two, Colin.
My number two is Inside Out.
That's mine, too.
Yes.
Wow.
Inside Out.
All right.
Pixar's best since WALL-E.
Agreed.
Yeah.
100%.
Okay. Are we all going to have the same number one?
I think we are.
Maybe we should just say it at the same time.
Okay.
Sure.
Mad Max Fury Road. Whoa. Last time this happened was 2003.
Return of the King.
Return of the King.
Yeah.
That was the last. How in God's name did this happen?
It's that great.
Because it's Mad Max Fury Road.
That's awesome.
Right.
You guys didn't include. I'm sorry. Hold on, real quickly. You guys didn't include Hateful Eight in your top 20?
23.
Yeah, 23 for me too.
Wow.
Length got me the same.
Oh, man, I could have gone on for another 6 hours. all right, Mad Max Fury Road. Everybody knows what it is at this point.
Yeah.
It is a remarkable piece of work. George Miller directed the crap out of it. And it is, to me, as soon as I saw it, I didn't think there was going to be anything better this year.
Yeah.
Okay, here's the deal. We got to fly through some stuff here. We're done, right? Can we go? Yeah, we're done.
Can we, podcast the rest of this?
Yeah. Okay, we can do this.
Yeah, we can make it, a special internet-only for the...
Okay. All right, let's do the worst real
quick. Do the worst, and then we'll do our special subcategories as a special
And podcast. That'll be podcast-only. Okay, cool. All right. Well, let's do the worst, then, okay? We've got our best in there. Well, all three of us picked Mad Max Fury Road as the best movie of the year.
Yes.
Unprecedented. Mm-hmm. It's only happened once before.
And Colin and I have the same top three.
Yeah,
that's
wow. Remarkable right there.
Unbelievable.
Yep.
Okay, let me fly through the 20 worst movies, my 20 worst movies. Number 20, Chappie. Number 19, The Perfect Guy. Number 18, Insidious 3. Number 17, wait a minute, 17? Sinister 2, 16, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., 15, Poltergeist, 14, Paul Blart 2, 13, 50 Shades of Grey, which I didn't even get through on HBO, 12, The Boy Next Door, whoa, number 1, By the Sea, number 10, Rock the Casbah, number 9, Taken 3, number 8, Transporter Refueled, number 7, Terminator Genesis, number 6, Entourage, number 5, Get Hard, number 4, Pixels, number 3, The Gallows, Number two, No Escape. Number one, worst movie of 2015, The Ridiculous Six. Makes you want to maybe not subscribe to Netflix.
So many of those I didn't see. I'm so glad.
All right.
Number 20, Gem and the Holograms. 19, Pan. 18, The Cobbler. 17, By the Sea. 16, Hot Tub Time Machine 2. 15, The Seventh Son. 14, Mordecai. 13, Chappie. 12, Poltergeist. 11, Fantastic Four. 10, Do You Believe? 9, The Longest Ride. 8, Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse. 7, Love the Coopers. 6, 50 Shades of Grey. 5, Unfriended. 4, The Gallows. 3, Entourage. 2, Paul Blart 2. And number 1, The Boy Next Door.
Okay. Eric, worst.
Number 20, Concussion. 19, The Longest Ride. 18, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. 17, Hitman, Agent 47. 16, Project Almanac. 15, The Duff. 14, Poltergeist. 13, Selfless. 12, Zipper. 11, The Little Death. 10, Terminator Genesis. 9, Hot Tub Time Machine 2. 8, The Perfect Guy. 7, Aloft. 6, The Boy Next Door. 5, The Divergent Series Insurgent. 4, The Gallows. 3, Fort Tilden. 2, Jupiter Ascending. And number 1, 50 Shades of Grey.
All right.
It's not even a movie.
No, it's terrible. All right. Well, thank you guys so much. We do want to make a quick announcement here. We have, we're going to talk a little bit more, and we've got some subcategories that we're going to get to, and we might talk a little bit more about some of the other movies on the best list that we didn't get a chance to expound upon a little bit. And we're going to do that on podcast. So here's what you need to do. You need to download our podcast. This is going to be a podcast exclusive, available on our website at WGN Radio. Podcast exclusive. We will talk about the subcategories, tons of other stuff. So more 2015 movie talk with Colin, Eric, and Nick, available only on podcast. So that's why you need to download our podcast right now at iTunes and subscribe, or go to WGNRadio.com, where you will only be able to hear our continuing conversation about the movie year. And Eric, Colin, thank you guys so much for coming down.
Thank you, man.
Okay, have a great year. We're looking forward to 2016. We'll do it all over again.
Yeah.